Hi, my name is Angela Lewis from Org Culture Bites. Thank you for joining us in this podcast series, where we'll be talking to a number of Australians who are local thought leaders and experts making a positive impact on Australian workplaces. Today, I will be interviewing Steve Tighe, the author of the book Rethinking Strategy, which is published by Wiley this year, 2019. Steve has a rich background working for iconic Australian brands in roles that are predominantly focused on generating insights from data and also achieving strategy formulation with teams. So he's built up his expertise in strategic foresight as a futurist, and he now has his own business. This year, Steve also launched his book Rethinking Strategy through Wiley Publishing. This book provides a broad yet quite rigorous view into the world of strategy formulation, something that often remains quite secret or unknown to many of us. But with his easygoing style, Steve helps us to understand how the rules and paradigms surrounding strategic thinking are shifting alongside our changing environment. Steve describes how we can all be better at understanding strategy, participating in its creation, anticipating the future, even slowing down change and improving the way we make decisions. Today, I'm very grateful to share some of Steve's time, as he has kindly agreed to have an interview with me and talk about some of his experiences, some of the learning and advice that he can share about strategy and the future in our workplaces. Hey, Steve, thanks so much for joining us today. The first question I'd like to ask you is really, what is it that you do? So you're about foresight and being a strategic futurist. Can you tell me exactly what it is that you do?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on, Angela. So, yeah, look, I'd probably classify myself these days as a strategic designer. So I design strategies for organisations, and I suppose my approach to strategy, it really goes down that foresight pathway, if you like, where my focus for strategy development is very much on understanding how the future operating environment that an organisation is basically going to have to compete in, how that environment might evolve or change into the future, and therefore what are the implications then for the organisation in terms of its strategic positioning, and what it actually, you know, what its objectives may be, and what it actually may do, and how it may do it. So I guess with strategic foresight, the difference, I think, to conventional strategy is that strategic foresight puts the future first. It deliberately focuses on trying to understand how the operating environment could be different, and what are then the strategic implications for us, you know, as an organisation. And so I think that's how I'd classify myself, actually, a strategic designer.
Okay. So that makes sense. And in reading your book, Rethinking Strategy, I got the impression that it wasn't just about numbers and data, but actually you were working with organisations to create something unique and specific to that business.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about your methodology and how you help businesses be distinctive in the marketplace?
Yeah. Well, my principal technique in formulating strategy is through the use of scenarios and scenario planning. Now, scenarios are nothing new. You know, they've been used to varying degrees in a business context for around 50 years now. Despite the fact they've been around so long, I think they're largely misunderstood. And if you were to ask 10 or 20 different managers what their understanding of scenarios is, you'd probably get 10 or 20 different responses. And that's certainly in my been my experience when I've held scenario workshops. And that's one of the things that I really try to articulate in the book as well. But in terms of, you mentioned relying on numbers and tables and so forth, which again, I think if you look at how a strategy is traditionally developed, there's such a reliance on tables and data. And a fellow author called Peter Schwartz made the comment that it's almost as if something is in a table, it comes with a great deal of more authenticity. And I think, though, that when you come to develop scenarios for the longer-term future, say 5, 10, 20 years out, etc., one of the things that you're dealing with is largely an absence of data and tables and facts. And therefore, you need to rely a lot more on different methods and processes to clarify your thinking on how the future could be different. But you also, you rely a lot more on your intuition. And for me, when I started getting into the field of scenario planning, and I'll talk a little bit about what scenarios are in a minute, but that pivot, if you like, from relying on data and trends, so letting go of that safety net, if you like, and then relying much more on your intuition, that was a huge leap for me. You almost had to deprogram the way that you were raised in a corporate environment. You know, I was very, in my first 8 years at CUB or Foster's, which mm-hmm. is where I worked, in market analysis, and I was very, very heavily involved in analysing trends and data and so forth, as deeply as involved as you could possibly get. And so then, as I said, to make the switch from that reliance to then thinking in terms of future scenarios and what the world could look like in say 10 years time, that was quite a hurdle for me to overcome. And so, you know, with scenarios, they are stories about the future, right? And because let's talk about a scenario for 2030. There's no facts about 2030. And so therefore, all you've really got is your kind of your intuition, if you like. So letting go of facts was a big thing. And also, when you say, well, scenarios are stories, you know, all of a sudden, people, you know, you talk to managers managers don't like stories, because stories say, well, hang on, we're starting to get into a shaky ground. But, well, if you're going to plan for 2030, you really haven't got much else.
Yeah, that's right. It makes a lot of sense. I think also, though, it's quite difficult for leaders and managers to stop and take that time away from the day-to-day and really think collectively about the future. I'm working with a few organisations at the moment who are trying to build greater proactivity into their culture, so to be less reactive and more active and adaptive to change, so they can be positioned more at the front of the wave rather than, you know, through the end. So to survive, they can't afford to avoid the issues or to put their heads in the sand or to be a laggard, because the customers expect the businesses to be proactive, to address the problems, you know, before they become the reason why people don't choose them. And I'm talking about customers as well as employees there. But it takes a lot of courage to stop and take the time to think ahead and confront those issues before they happen. So tell us a little bit more about how scenarios may be able to help us out there to become more proactive.
So, yeah, scenarios are stories about the future, and they basically just tell a story about a series of outcomes or events and outcomes that could unfold into the future. And their whole purpose, therefore, is to provide that as a backdrop to say, okay, if this did occur and it's strategically significant for us as an organisation, what would we do? And so the whole purpose of scenarios is to enable you to rehearse your response. And I'm sure we'll cover it later, but it's that lack of rehearsal that leaves managers scrambling when they are met with unforeseen circumstances, because they're totally unprepared for it. And you see that. We've seen that in so many high-profile examples over the last, you know, 5 or so years, where organisations, you know, get struck seemingly from nowhere. But if they actually had been looking, the signals were probably all around them. That's probably quite a long way of answering your question there, Ange.
No, that's good, thank you. So what I'm hearing there is that, you know, we've had this reliance on data-based evidence to help us understand the current view and what's happened in the past. But what you're really saying is, if you want to have a really good grasp or help your organisation have a better grasp on how to deal with the future, you actually need to use more of your intuition and your creativity to collectively come about with what the future could hold and what the possibilities are.
Absolutely. And creativity is a really interesting word, because, you know, a forecast is just the extrapolation of a historical trend, okay? And the danger, the deception in a forecast is that it cannot include discontinuities, okay? Because it's an extrapolation. And so it paints the picture of the future as this linear thing in front of you, but there will always be discontinuities, and it's the discontinuities that provide those once-in-a-lifetime opportunities for a step change in performance. So you, if you're prepared for them, the discontinuities are your best friend. If you're not prepared for them, that's where we get the lazy term disruption. And so if you accept that it's the discontinuities that you want, and that's really where organisations want to get to, how do we design a process that enables us to anticipate and prepare for discontinuities before they occur? I think that's the ultimate goal of strategy. And that's what you're searching for.
And perhaps then that's where our opportunity lies. So for organisations and HR as leaders, designing those processes that help lift our view to pause and look ahead, to shine a light on what's happening around us and momentarily think beyond the day-to-day, even embedding forums where we can look at our predictions and see, you know, are we on the right track or have conditions changed and are they different to the ones that we may have anticipated? So we should perhaps then be thinking about activities that make us ask these questions about signals and what they're indicating. Are the discontinuities what we thought they would be, or are they indeed something different, and are we still prepared for what lies ahead, or do we need to adjust?
Discontinuities are going to occur if you can take advantage of them. As I said, you know, that's your Halley's Comet, because they're irregular, but they're quite impactful. And as I said, on the flip side, if you're not prepared. So how do you see them? If the extrapolation of a trend's not going to give it to you, and that's where your intuition and creativity come to the forefront. Okay, and that's really the power that underlies the stories of the scenarios, because good scenarios bring those discontinuities to the fore. And remember, with a scenario, you're not trying to predict the future. What you're really trying to do is expedite organizational learning. Okay, and this is where, once you let go of any kind of pretense about trying to predict the future, say, you know, no, what we're trying to do here is learn about the future, to learn about what could happen, and more importantly, what would we do if that happened? And, you know, that's no different in an organisational sense. That is no different to what sporting clubs do every week at training. They rehearse scenarios so that when they get to game day, when the players get in certain situations, they know how to respond. They know their teammates know where to be, etc., etc. And for some reason, rehearsing scenarios, which is done in sporting teams, in the military, etc., you know, a pilot learning to pilot an aeroplane works through, you know, thousands of hours of scenarios, but in organisations, we don't do it.
So why is that, do you think? So that concept of practice helps you become, if not perfect, it helps you understand your reactions and your responses to different scenarios.
Yep.
Why is it that organisations aren't doing this, do you think?
I think it's because I think scenarios remain largely misunderstood. I think as an outcome of that misunderstanding, I think when they have been used, they've been less than effective, or they've been misused. And look, I tell this story in the book, and it took me, I've been now doing scenarios for 15 years, but in the early stages, I'd do scenarios, and they were really just probably extrapolations of trends, so they were kind of surprise-free, so they were useful, but they weren't great. And then I moved on, and I would do scenarios, but I didn't then bring it back to the organisation to say, and this is what it means for you. So my fixation was on what could happen, but I wasn't being organisationally useful. That is where a lot of people who do scenarios, they leave it there. They do this exercise where they say, well, this could happen or this could happen, and then, you know, they walk out the door. So the organisation is really left none the wiser about what. Now, what do we do with them? Again, there's a chapter there called So What? And it's the failure to address the so what question, to take responsibility for the so what question, that I think many practitioners have failed to do. And so what happens is the organisation says, well, you know what? It was an interesting exercise. We enjoyed it, but nothing really came of it, and we probably wouldn't do it again. And I would argue that is where the majority of scenario projects have ended up. So it's largely a self-inflicted wound, and it comes down to taking responsibility for the so what. And look, the reason you need to step up and take that responsibility is that when you're presenting alternate futures to managers, Well, their expertise is in the here and now. There's no use presenting stuff to them and they're left with thinking, well, yeah, but how are they relevant to us? You've got to help them make that connection. So drawing those future landscapes or developing those future landscapes is merely one third or one half of the job. You've literally got to have the skills, I think, and the hunger, if you like, to help them to see how they can position their organisations within each of those futures and how they can exploit their capabilities to succeed in those futures. Mm. You know, that took me probably 10 years of practising before, you know, I realised that I was only really doing half my job. And I think it's that disappointment with the effectiveness of scenarios that really lies at the core of their failure to take hold within businesses, mm-hmm. as other methodologies such as a SWOT analysis and so forth, which are now really, you know, mainstream.
I see that a lot too. I think, you know, the failure to really delve into and then act on that so what. It's particularly true, I think, for organisations moving into that action planning phase after big survey results. You know, I often feel that there's this lead up to sessions, action planning sessions, where managers can get a little frustrated with you that it's taking up their time and, you know, everyone's too busy for this, just give me the numbers. But when they're actually in the workshops with their teams, they get so many aha moments and the energy around the ideas and the, you know, the thoughts of what they can do to make a real difference and have an impact can be quite exhilarating. And then, unfortunately, though, there's this lag, and when it comes to implementation, all too often you see that this really good work comes unstuck again, and it gets hard and the day-to-day sort of takes over and the people lose that critical connection to the so what as it gets replaced then by the too hard. So I really like in your book how you've broken it down into parts that really focus on the what, the why, and then the how. You've seen, you know, a real opportunity to build organisation-wide capability in those really valuable acts of thinking, imagining, preparing, and then adjusting to uncertainty and change in our world.
That was really one of the goals, probably the primary goal with writing the book, was to say, how do I write something? This is an idea that I passionately believe in. I think the time's absolutely appropriate for different methodologies to be used within organisations. So why is it that this 50-year-old idea hasn't still taken off? There's plenty of textbooks around. The whole purpose of writing was to make an organisational impact. What I've tried to do is to really break down that misunderstanding and that misuse of scenarios. So how can I write a book that will not only increase understanding, but really improve the competency and the take-up of scenario planning within organisations? The logic, in an uncertain world, the logic of planning for multiple futures, so accepting that the future could go one way or the other, I mean, that is just logic that, you know, obviously absolutely makes sense. So therefore, why wouldn't we then incorporate that approach into our strategic planning within our organisation? So the logic's there, but perhaps I still saw the opportunity to write a textbook that would make it as easy as possible for people to apply that practice within their organisations.
So it sounds like there's some good work you do around creating those future scenarios, but the critical link is around then applying it to the here and now, and how do you build that pathway. Mm-hmm. Can you help me understand or share your experience around when do you actually see that there's success and traction with creating a pathway and moving towards that future scenario? What are the indicators for you that you're on the right path or businesses are doing the right thing to connect the future view with the current view and creating the right pathway?
Well, I think the third necessary step to creating that pathway is almost that now what. So you can do this, the so what step, which is about how do you position the organisation to be successful in multiple futures. But the step that I found that was missing up until recently in my own practice was that final step about now what. And that's about what are these actions, or what do these scenarios now mean for our more immediate priorities, or for our organisational business units. So making that link in terms of you have a longer term future, but then bringing that back to what does that now mean for our next 4 years, that's the essential link that's also missing. So almost that operational plan or implementation plan, which is now developed within the broader context of your, say, strategic framework or your scenarios. And I think that's the absolute key. The other thing with scenarios, I think there's a couple of steps. One is, you know, what could happen? Okay, so that's where you start to say, well, what could 2030 look like? The second step to that is, well, why could that happen? Tell me the drivers or the factors that you see are changing today or emerging today that could actually lead to that what. So what could happen? Why could it happen? The third question then is, how could it happen? So you tell me, Paul, you know, it's just not going to happen overnight. So what are some of those plausible steps that could lead to that end scenario? So that's your how. Now, when you answer the how, that then gives you these essential signposts, if you like. And the effect of doing the how, which is really about, you know, that gateway to how the future could develop, the outcome of that is that you become so sensitive as an individual and as an organisation to signals that otherwise you may have missed, and certainly your competitors would not be seeing. And I find that organisational sensitivity in terms of you detect signals of change well and truly before they've matured, that to me that is one of the great strategic advantages and on a sustainable strategic advantage that comes from the scenario process. Mm.
That sounds a lot to me like building organisational agility. We know that good strategy requires the ability to be futuristic, and good execution requires the collective ability to be able to actively adjust to whatever comes your way. So these signals help to validate the soundness of strategy and guide actions of your people to either continue on that right path or, in fact, review the situation, so potentially being in advance of others. So in summary, this is how, in using scenarios, proactivity and agility can help organisations lead their industry. Steve, do you have any examples that you could share where you've seen some signals, or your organisations that you've partnered with have started to see the signals before their competitors?
Yeah, sure. In 2012, one of the landmark case studies that I worked on was for the Victorian Public Library Network. So they had a project, was what could a public library look like in the year 2030? So it was basically a 20-year horizon. Some of the factors we looked at there, the actual factors that drove our scenarios, were we had a creative scenario which was really driven by the shift in society to more post-materialistic values. And we had another scenario that was really driven by the growing distrust of traditional gatekeepers. Now, I found, if you reflect on that in 2012, the growing distrust of traditional gatekeepers was so foresightful as a driver. And I remember at the time thinking, well, how is that really relevant to the future of public libraries? But, you know, we created a scenario out of that, which was about people losing trust in these large gatekeepers and people returning back to their communities.
So who were the large gatekeepers that you talk about?
Media, politics, mm-hmm. banks, a lot of these institutions that have faced a backlash over the last couple of years, and also that lack of trust in large corporations, etc. And I think these are themes that have become so prominent over the last 2 or 3 years. We covered those issues. We also covered post-materialism, and with post-materialism we saw a de-emphasising on consumption and a ramping up of people's interest in creativity. So when you now see that Australia has now had 3 consecutive quarters of per capita consumption decline, there's no surprise there, because to me that is just confirming that, well, we are de-emphasising our materialistic pursuits and we're starting to become more post-materialistic as a society. So in that scenario, we had a sustained period of per capita decline. So I'm talking not three quarters. We're talking about a 10-year period. It won't feel like a recession. It just will feel like people are shifting their priorities in the community. And why would a per capita decline in consumption make sense? Because there's so much fat already in the system. And you only have to reflect on the size of your own wardrobe, for example, and what proportion of your clothes you actually use versus how much actually lie dormant. And that's what I mean. So just decluttering will be one of the factors that leads to kind of this kind of per capita decline. So when you see that, you're not surprised. when you see that we've had record low interest rates for 8 years now, and they're at 1% or 1.25%, whatever it may be, you're not surprised by that, because interest rates lose their leverage in a post-materialistic society. When we're at the peak of materialism, the Reserve Bank would tweak interest rates. People took their $25 a week and they'd go shopping, okay? They consume. Now, post-materialism is not about capability. It's about a mindset. It's about an attitude to consuming material and to owning stuff. So you can tweak interest rates, no response, tweak them again. And so the Reserve Bank and a lot of our economic indicators are almost built for a different paradigm. They haven't caught up with the current zeitgeist. And so they still talk about concepts like consumer confidence is down because people aren't shopping. What you need to realise, the much broader picture, is that there's a fundamental social shift that's occurring in which different indicators will be necessary. So again, I'm not a qualified economist or whatever, but I, through my own intuition and in building these scenarios, a post-materialistic scenario would indeed include many of those indicators which I've just talked about. So when you see that Jacinda Ardern brings out a well-being budget in May 2019, a well-being budget is in our 2012 scenarios. So you're not surprised by headlines anymore. You say, well, that makes sense when you see it. And not only that, it confirms that we're heading down this pathway. And we recently just had a 7-year review of those scenarios, and everything still appears on track. All the indicators that we're seeing confirm that we're heading down the track of those two scenarios. The positioning that public libraries have adopted in being creative community centres, etc., much more vibrant, almost active learning centres, if you like, that positioning is still absolutely appropriate for the direction and for the wants and needs of communities in 2020, 25 and 30. You know, you become sensitive to these signals, and where others may be surprised by them or not really know where they fit, because you have these future contexts of 2030 and you have assumptions built into those, you see signals like that and you say, well, that absolutely makes sense.
In a way, you're perhaps also challenging the business status quo through that shift in mindset. Will more organisations also reflect this post-materialistic mindset and way of operating that better meets the needs of the evolving community? I'm thinking, for example, adjusting the expectation on desired profit margins to cut down the fat, or be more benevolent with the profits, giving it back to the customer, the employee, the community or the environment, as we've seen many conscious organisations really do more of. So, you know, I'm looking at, you know, will the attractiveness of an organisation be measured in the future by dividends not only to shareholders but also to other stakeholders as well? And so going back to your point, Steve, as a business, you can either continue to go forward confirming your past assumptions are still valid, or you might find something that comes, new technology, a need to respond, or like a shift in these values that might take you on a different pathway.
But in either case, your advantage is at least you have a hypothesis for 2030. If you don't have a hypothesis, you haven't got a box to put or a filing cabinet in which to place the signal, or indeed to say that signal doesn't fit. So it's the hypothesis for the future that gives you your advantage. Absolutely.
So thinking forward and preempting. This concludes part one of our interview with Steve Tighe. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again for the second part of this interview, where we'll look more closely at the importance of the strategy process. We will also explore the role of HR as leaders in the design and implementation of strategy processes that enable organisational learning and building of this shared hypothesis about the future that supports strategy execution. Steve Tighe is a leading business strategist, author and speaker on the future, strategy and innovation. For more information about Steve Tighe, his book called Rethinking Strategy, or to inquire about his workshops and presentations, please visit his website www.stevetighe.com.au. If you would like to know how you can take on a greater leadership role in building a contemporary high-performance culture, or looking at designing and embedding effective strategy formulation processes, or indeed expediting learning in your organisation through scenario planning, please contact Angela Lewis at Org Culture Bytes via the email newcustomerinquiry@orgculturebytes.com. Thank you.